You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina. Serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Sonia Soraya writes this month's first-person column, Seeing Stars, Astrology Isn't Science, So Why Can't I Stop Trying to Divine the Intention of the Heavens? Opening illustration by Antti Kalevi. The language of astrology now permeates the mainstream, luring even natural-born skeptics. This illustration shows a woman lying on her back, with her book tossed aside, gazing up at the night sky. Three or four times a year, Mercury appears to loop back on itself for a period of about 3 weeks before continuing on its journey. The smaller planet doesn't actually go backward, it just looks that way because we're orbiting the Sun at a far slower pace. All the planets can appear to us to be traveling in reverse. Mars, for example, was retrograde this summer, in a gorgeous transit that made the planet glow like a portentous red eye low on the twilight horizon. To the ancients, the bright, mysterious, meandering planets told a story. Mercury's has endured into the present to become the kooky spiritualist go-to excuse. If the Roman god of communication, tricksters, and travelers is caught in a loop, heaven help us mere mortals. On a humid summer Friday in Park Slope, I stopped in front of a twee shop window with a poster-sized decal on it. Your 2018 Mercury in retrograde public service announcement, it declared. Ticking off advisements. Don't close the deal. Don't initiate new projects. Don't schedule meetings. Don't travel a lot and don't repair your car, purchase technology, make agreements, or accept or start a job. I had my reservations, grammatically and otherwise. Mercury is never in retrograde. It is retrograde. And I'd love to meet the wafflers who won't finish anything for 3 weeks at a time. Yet I had, at that point, been weighed down in a cloud of faulty communication. An editor rescheduled the same interview 4 times. For some reason, none of my text would send. Maybe I should have been following the rules. The language of astrology in our millennial moment has emerged from the dusty corners of hippie bookstores to permeate the mainstream with chic vigor. It's popular, progressive, and often quite stylish. Yoga teachers, massage therapist, and acupuncturist have dished their horoscopic concerns to me. Academics and poets are conversant. At a wedding in 2017, the sister of the groom told me she'd keep an eye on my transits with the help of an app. A co-worker informed me, sotto voce, that no one on our team was a Cancer. And then there's me, reminding people to keep the faith during the storms of eclipse season or at the threshold of a new moon. How did this happen to us? To me? I don't do healing crystals. I have a healthy skepticism of miracle cures and nutritional fads. So why does this web of astral significance speak to me? At least part of the answer is that I live on the internet, where automated Twitter accounts give updates on planetary transits, apps offer minute details about the heavens, and crucially, anyone can access their birth chart. There may be no greater manifestation of a purported millennial penchant for navel-gazing than obsessing over a snapshot of the heavens at the time and place of one's arrival. And yet, astrology links that moment to two of the biggest mysteries of a person's existence. Why am I the way I am? And what is going to happen to me? The universe is pitiless and vast, but when all else fails, you can pore over a diagram to study your place in it. This summer, a familiar self-loathing roared back into my life. Depression is always useless, but it's especially useless when everything else is going pretty well. Somehow, I got a job writing for this magazine and convinced a nice man to marry me. Still, I couldn't shake a sense of dread I'd been carrying my whole life. It feels like a dark, spreading stain at the center of my mind, one that I carefully keep at bay with my pill and my therapist and occasional half-hearted jogging. But these don't always work, and sometimes the stain bleeds out. Everybody has a struggle like that, right? If it's not dread, it's despair or grief. And there on that liminal battlefield, where it's going in the right direction, but it feels really bad, that's where astrology really works. It gives us the tools to tell stories for ourselves, to rewrite personal drama as a clash of planetary forces, to reinterpret trauma as one step on a journey toward peace. And it does feel magical when a reading appears to know you intimately, when it reveals to you something you weren't aware of, or something you had not yet said out loud. So this summer, I read posts from astrologer Chani Nicholas for guidance. Other things that helped: fancy ice cream, vaping, listening to The Weeknd. I'm not proud. She assured her readers that it was an intense time, especially for those of us with Capricorn, my rising sign, in our chart. I keep returning to one question she posed late in August. What does it mean to get to live even a teeny tiny part of your dream? Later, when I spoke to Nicholas for this piece, I found myself telling her about a moment I'd had recently, sitting on the fire escape, looking at the sky, and trying not to cry. A star was directly overhead, and my phone told me it was Vega, Capricorn's next-door neighbor. Gradually, we both realized the same thing. I had been staring at the astrological upheaval of the summer, retrograde Mars in my rising sign. The red planet was slowly drawing a bright path over the exact point in the sky that was dawning in the east the morning I was born. My whole life, my mother has handed me bizarre, charmed objects, rocks with fossils in them, dried seeds, semi-precious stones on a chain, with instructions to wear them, wield them, or keep them on a shelf. This is all strange, sure, but given that she was raising us to be Hindu in Central Florida, everything my mother asked us to do was strange. For much of my family, momentous decisions like choosing a wedding date or naming a child would not go forward without first consulting an astrologer. I remember my mom reading Linda Goodman's Love Signs before bed, the big volume propped up on the comforter. I also remember an impersonal printout bound in a red and yellow paper folder from an astrologer in India she'd sent away for my natal chart. My mother allowed me to consult it as a teenager, but then locked it away, cautioning that too much future gazing is unhealthy. Before I started teasing her for it, my mother would call me at each anniversary of the start of her 36-hour labor, or when she had her last meal, Big Macs, before arriving at the hospital. But I discovered only recently that the time she gave the astrologer, the time she told me, the time I've used to calculate my birth charts, is wrong. My dad sent me my legal birth certificate. There's a discrepancy of 9 minutes. Learning this sent me into a tailspin. If it were just 8 minutes off, I'd still be a Capricorn rising. At the 9th minute, though, Aquarius began to dawn on the horizon. This didn't bother my mother in the slightest. Just chuck it, she advised. She, who gave me the printout, the wrong time, and the tentative belief in magic. I think, I believe that Mars, tracing the path along my ascendant this summer, brought me back to the beginning of my story for a reason. There is a lot to fear in this life. Climate change, the GOP, turning into one's mother. But it is crippling to check one's every movement against the stars, to live in so much fear of the universe. I am terrified of the world, but I cannot deny how much it has given me, too. Maybe I don't know the exact moment of my birth, but I do know that my mother labored in those minutes, and so did I. Every now and then, it's good to be reminded that the first thing you did on this earth was fight to survive, to take up space, to scream, to thrive. And if the movement of planets is telling a story, then I want to be a part of it. Once in a while, in the moments when I think I might be okay, I feel like I am just one tiny piece of the universe engaged in a cosmic dance without end. The cosmos is unfolding to unheard music, and the planets are keeping time. And for what it's worth, I knew I loved my fiancé when I first saw him dance. So I asked Chani Nicholas for one single piece of personal guidance, when to get hitched. She came back to me with a time in December, super early, like 8:30 a.m. early. That's what I get for asking the universe for help. I don't know if we'll make it to City Hall in time, but I'm glad to know we can try. Letter from the North by Joel Stein. From Tocqueville to Trump, Vanity Fair audits a Canadian college course on the U.S. president. Opening photo illustration by Emily Sims. In a Toronto class, making America decipherable again. Books spread out on the desk, erasers, markers, and a cup of essential coffee. When Donald Trump was elected president, we knew that someone was going to have to explain it to Canada. Journalist Sam Tenenhouse seemed like a solid choice. Having written books about conservatives that are beloved by his fellow liberals, Tenenhouse had a shot at explaining far-right nationalism to a people flummoxed by their southern neighbors' love of guns, refusal to compost, fear of socialized medicine, and preference for any sport ever invented over hockey. So for his Trump and the Media course at the University of Toronto, Tenenhouse figured he'd begin slowly, starting with a nice chunk of Tocqueville and working his way to the JFK-Nixon debates. He'd begin the first class by asking his students if they knew any Trump voters in the States, and when no one's hand went up, he'd patiently explain that nearly half of Americans voted for him, and then go on from there. But to his surprise, up went a sea of hands. "Right now, you have more to tell me than the newsroom of the New York Times," Tenenhouse said about the place he'd worked for a dozen years. He is also a contributor to Vanity Fair. After that first session, Tenenhouse decided to rip up the syllabus and informally rename the course Trump in Real Time. For 2 hours each week, he leads a discussion about Trump and the news cycle, sometimes in literal real time. The 180 students, 140 of them women, watched the Brett Kavanaugh hearings on a huge screen as they were happening, with Tenenhouse occasionally waiting for the commotion to die down. Turns out that even college students in Canada think it's weird to like beer that much. You, a fine upstanding member of the mainstream media reading cognoscenti, probably had one of two reactions to hearing about a college course on Donald Trump. One is gasping. I know an American professor who became hysterical at the mere mention of Trump's name in a course title, says English professor and critic Randy Boyagoda, the university administrator who came up with the idea for the class. The other reaction is more common. You say Trump in a serious context, and they laugh. It's a lizard brain reaction of the elites, says Boyagoda, who just finished writing a novel in which Trump takes a post-presidency job as the host of an extreme weather channel. Boyagoda knew that danger lies in indulging such smugness, and he warned Tenenhouse that the students might be expecting him to spend 2 hours a week making fun of Trump. That is not what is happening in the class. These students are from the first generation steeped in reality TV, Twitter, memes, and GIFs. They are immune to Trump shock, a trait which allows them to coolly analyze the first president to grab the levers of those media. I'm more excited to hear them talk about social media than to spend my time talking to journalists, says Tenenhouse. He's standing a few feet from the lectern, doling out advice to the scrum of students who surround him before and after class. This is the week in which Tenenhouse intends to get to that 1971 Daniel Patrick Moynihan essay he assigned weeks ago. But CNN's Jem Acosta has just been barred from White House press briefings, which means Tenenhouse is going to have trouble just getting to the midterm election coverage. Moynihan will have to wait. Again, it's hard to run a class on Trump, especially when you're dissecting the media's role in covering a president devoted to exploiting and exploding the media. Teaching one of the few college courses anywhere focused entirely on Trump, Tenenhouse, who has had some interest in exporting the class to a U.S. institution, is helping to figure out what the future discipline of Trump studies will be. Great idea, says presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, praising the notion of examining journalists who write the first draft of history to get an up-to-the-minute look at the inner workings of the relationship between the media and the president. But so far, at least, it's less about historical perspective than about performance. When Stephanie Kerth, an American studies major who was taking the course as an exchange student from Germany, tries to imagine a day when she might be teaching a class on Trump, years from now, she pauses, you can't make sense of him, so you can't study his ideas. Maybe we've come to the place where you just study journalists yelling at each other. Marshall McLuhan, the 1960s media theorist who coined the terms the medium is the message and global village, would be horrified by a class staring at a large monitor, parsing cable news flotsam and Twitter jetsam. McLuhan is also the most likely to have taught this class. His old office is just a couple of buildings away. McLuhan was a professor at St. Michael's, one of seven colleges at the University of Toronto, from 1946 to 1980. His legacy inspired the book and media studies program, also at St. Michael's, that is now offering Trump in the media. When students line up for office hours, they wait by a cardboard cutout of a seated McLuhan before they go in to discuss their assignments, such as the one in which they had to tweet in the style of At Real Donald Trump. One student handed this in. Cory Booker, who ran Newark into the ground, is using this sham to launch his primary campaign, and I hope he wins. Cory will be even easier to beat than Crooked Hillary. When Tannenhaus looks like a professor who could have worked alongside McLuhan, plaid wool jacket, glasses, gray beard, a face oft mistaken for Wolf Blitzer's, he's got an unprofessorial energy, talking loudly and quickly. He spits his ire less at the president than at his fellow journalist. Pausing a clip of CNN's Sound and Fury graphics during the midterms to comment, one thing I can't stand is minor projections. I'm really a major projection guy. His teaching style is more reporter than lecturer, preferring to ask questions rather than opine, and impressively canvassing the class's expertise. He calls on a Saudi Arabian student to explain how the Jamal Khashoggi murder is being hidden from the citizens of her country. And he wants to hear from the Canadian student who drove to Michigan to volunteer for a Democratic congressional candidate. He remembers there's a kid taking classes in video editing who can analyze how the White House posted an altered clip in which, to create the illusion of physical interaction, several frames had been frozen at the moment Jem Acosta's arm touched a female intern's. Not only do these students know a lot about the world, they know a lot about American politics. While Tannenhaus and yours truly struggle to name the 10 Canadian provinces, Prince Edward Island, really? These students know the deadline for Florida to review ballot signatures. But while they can vigorously debate nuances of statistician Nate Silver's poll analysis, or whether Trump is an anti-Semite, the liberal Canadian students never seem to take his side. That said, when the teaching assistants graded the midterms, they were startled. A fair number of students, on paper, expressed pro-Trump opinions. All the students, though, appear to love the course. Some seem besotted when Tannenhaus mentions texting with Steve Bannon or knowing Ben Jacobs, whose body slamming by Montana Republican Congressman Greg Gianforte was praised by Trump. And lo and behold, Boyagoda says, the class is inspiring students to become journalists. At least half a dozen, including fourth-year student Max Levy, who sits transfixed in class, sipping a kale mango smoothie in a reusable bottle, say they have put aside law school applications. The university, in fact, is so pleased with Trump 101, the enrollment, the media attention, the student engagement, that Boyagoda is hoping to apply the principle to other topics. He's thinking of trying a hashtag MeToo and the media course next. Or he could just let Tannenhaus keep going until either he or Trump gives up. It's the only way the professor's going to get to that Pat Moynihan essay. Now, here's this month's cover story, Laura Dern's Moment. Don't call it a Dernissance. The Big Little Lies star has always been a force. The world is just playing catch-up. By Sloane Crossley. Photographs by Julia Hetta. Styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Shades of Grey. Laura Dern photographed in New York City. And here she reclines on a gray couch, wearing shades of gray. Laura Dern emerges from the pitch dark. She is 19 years old, dressed as Sandy Williams in a pink short-sleeved dress, a hydrangea of blonde bangs protruding from her forehead. It's 1986, and Dern has appeared in several commercially successful films, including Mask, but it's David Lynch's Blue Velvet that functions as a debutante ball for a woman who was born Hollywood royalty. Under normal circumstances, it might feel tiresome to explain that Laura Dern is the daughter of Bruce Dern, himself a great-nephew of Archibald MacLeish, and Diane Ladd, herself a cousin of Tennessee Williams, that she is the goddaughter of Shelley Winters and one of the only actors working today with Coppola-level California roots. But these are not normal circumstances, because Dern's childhood, a swirling mass of famous faces like Gregory Peck, Jane Fonda, Jack Nicholson, and Jenna Rollins, is not a requisite mention, but an inextricable part of who she is, responsible for her passions and her pitfalls, and the key to one of the most elastic actresses of her generation. "I have never spent time with boring people," she says, as if confessing to never having entered a Walmart. "I've never once been at a meal where I've thought, oh, this person is a bore." It's 11 a.m. on a Sunday, and we are the only two diners in the cavernous Viale dei Romani restaurant. Somewhere, a cappuccino is being made. Dern is set to attend a reception for Alfonso Cuarón's Roma this afternoon. She has on a floral dress with a keyhole front, a cape-like white coat, and carries a tiny teal bag. She looks like a glamorous Easter egg, and kind of sounds like one. She is animated, funny, charming, and impeccably mannered. "My family's from the South," she says, reminding me of her Mississippi bloodline. "I'm a hugger." She also speaks deliberately, protectively, with the cadence of a seasoned professional accustomed to delivering whole paragraphs. Over the course of the 2 days I spend with her, I witness dual Dern engines, the primary one being that of a deeply genuine person, the secondary one being that of a person with a marrow-level awareness of sounding as genuine as she is. This is common for actors, particularly very smart ones. They pepper the occasional curse word or easy joke into a stream of articulate, unobjectionable ideas. The environment is a priority. Minority voices are vital. Sexual harassment is bad. Gun laws are too lax, as you slide into the uncanny valley of conversation. This is control, mind you, not fakeness. But Laura Dern is really good at it. We're in the middle of getting right to it, chatting about romance, when our food arrives. She plucks my cell phone from the table. At first, I think she has confused it for her cell phone, but instead she lifts the microphone to her face so my audio will be seamless, seasoned. I was raised by people who really honor non-judgment and empathy, and that's been an amazing inspiration as an artist, she explains. But it's not the best once you become an adult and choose relationships, especially intimate relationships, when you're raised to be boundary-free. You get to realize that the art doesn't necessarily match the individual. I do have difficulty with that separation. Those of us with less adorned childhoods are saddled with similar issues: boundaries, self-worth, ego, therapy's greatest hits. I reason that if anyone should have been magically inoculated against deifying creativity, it's Laura Dern. After all, she tells wonderfully down-to-earth stories about her parents and their friends. It was a privilege to grow up around dames. About Winters throwing on jeans and a mink coat for a movie premiere. And while her romances have been starry, they've also been civilian-like in duration. She's never gone for the blink-and-you'll-miss-it L.A. engagement. She reportedly dated Kyle MacLachlan for 4 years, Jeff Goldblum for another 4, and was engaged to Billy Bob Thornton until he unceremoniously left her for Angelina Jolie. She was later married for 8 years to Ben Harper, with whom she has 2 children, Ellery, 17, and Jaya, 14. The couple of crushes she has now include a long-standing one. I met him when I was 20, but I don't think he's aware. He's a filmmaker, a genius, but a kind genius. I've never had something that wasn't the real deal, she tells me another time, but real deals break your heart, too. I offer her a thought experiment. All the men you've ever loved are trapped in a room together. What do they make of each other? Well, how big is the room? She asks, laughing. No, it would be pretty joyful, and it would also be incredibly aggressive toward a couple of individuals. I have a bit of a mafia who know who's been there for me and who hasn't. It would be obvious. But all of these relationships, like my relationship with my kids, or my friends, or the characters I play, they teach me so much about myself, about how to use my voice, about how to channel anger and accept myself when the rest of the world says, you're too complicated, I don't want to be at the party with you. Our visions of ourselves die hard, but sometime between playing Reese Witherspoon's mother and 2014's Wild, after which the two became incredibly close, and Renata Klein, co-starring with Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman in HBO's Big Little Lies, the world decided that not only did it want to be at the party with Laura Dern, but that the party was for her. The internet has rather cheesily dubbed our current times as the Dernissance, but, point taken, her performance as Renata earned her both an Emmy and a Golden Globe. The second season of Big Little Lies, coming this spring, will feature more of that Dern-patented complex woman the world is finally catching up to. Indeed, if you Google Laura Dern and complex, your eyes will burn out on the results. When her career started to take off, she was offered tons of traditional stuff. She heard the siren song of John Hughes, but her parents were wary of her being hurled into celebrity. Much has been made of Dern's petitioning for parental emancipation as a teenager, but she says she did it for professional reasons, not to run away from home. The judge said to her, "Do you make a living wage?" recalls Bruce Dern. "I was sitting in the back, and she asked me, 'Do I make a living wage?' And I said, 'Yes, you make more than $22,000 a year.'" Her parents encouraged her to seek out character-driven roles over ingenues, to build a body of work so that I would end up having my most exciting years when I was a grown woman. To say this philosophy has paid off is an understatement, not only with David Lynch, with whom she has an enviable Sunday night tradition at the Chateau Marmont, we go for fried chicken and you can sit in the corner and smoke, but with Peter Bogdanovich, Robert Altman, Paul Thomas Anderson, Alexander Payne, and now Greta Gerwig, with whom she just finished wrapping production as Marmee in the remake of Little Women. Next photo, Dernissance woman. Dern is helping spearhead fundraising for the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures. To say this philosophy has paid off is an understatement. Over the years, this love of character has seeped into Dern's root system. She is a fearless actor, which is Hollywood for not afraid of looking ugly, but in her case, the fearlessness goes beyond the superficial. She has created a cottage industry out of playing deeply flawed, funny, cringe-inducing, infuriating anti-heroines. When she first read the script of Citizen Ruth, the 1996 black comedy about a paint-huffing vagrant whose pregnancy becomes a cri de coeur for pro-life and pro-choice fanatics, she'd never laughed so hard in her life. Her roles may not always play for laughs, but look closely and you'll see Dern has comedic timing in a league with her hero, Lucille Ball. It was Dern's expressive eyes Ellen DeGeneres stared into when she came out during Ellen's Watershed puppy episode, after which no one would hire Dern for a year. "She can play anything," says DeGeneres, who calls Dern a brilliant actress. "She can play a straight role, pardon the pun, and she's good at comedy. I knew she'd be the kind of person to open up Ellen Morgan. Dern and her mother both received Oscar nominations for the Depression-era drama Rambling Rose. In HBO's brilliant but short-lived Enlightened, Dern played Amy Jellicoe, a faux-woke would-be activist navigating office politics. The role won her a Golden Globe and is being re-mourned in the midst of what feels like a tectonic shift for difficult women across all industries. If Enlightened were on right now, given what's happening in the world, every woman would say, "I am Amy Jellicoe." But when it was on, says Dern, male journalists would interview me and relate, and female journalists would ask, "How do you feel playing such an unattractive character?" Perhaps the ultimate Dern versus the world role is the one we're about to see her in again. According to Dern, a second season of Big Little Lies will feature more real estate porn. Dern's own Santa Monica estate is homier. It feels like a treehouse, well, a mid-century treehouse. Further intimacy in how we get to know these women, which is Hollywood for I'm Not Telling You Squat About Squat, and Meryl Streep. The all-star cast helped manifest a second season of a show that was meant to have been a single-season series, and they've become close in the process. We have each other's backs, and there's obviously a mentoring aspect to it with Zoe Kravitz and Shailene Woodley. But we're all equal in terms of contributing ideas, and we're very, very bonded, says Kidman. We've worked together for so long now, but we've also navigated an enormous amount together. When we're in Monterey, it's just always, where are we going to dinner? What are we doing after? It's safe to assume Dern will continue to make Renata, the highest strung, high-powered mom in Monterey, enjoyable to watch, not because we love to hate her, but because we grow to love her. Dern has a surgical ability to reveal the hurt beneath a character's anger, to play women who have a longing to be heard or to hear themselves. She attributes the nuance of Renata's flaws to director Jean-Marc Vallée and writer David E. Kelly, but I have to point out what she won't. It's Dern who has to carry it home. I've never gravitated towards scripts where there's profound change. I'm interested in incremental growth. And it's so obvious to me how vulnerable Renata is, because you can feel her being like, she punches her palm, "You're going to listen to me. Nobody has to work that hard if they're really being listened to." Dern has some familiarity with Renata's DNA. There's the childhood of being seen and championed, but not really heard. And she, too, is a high-powered working mom. She sometimes, too, has to miss performances and swim meets, and not being there is excruciating. But this fluency comes at a price. Marmee is loving and only speaks to impart wisdom and revolutionize change. Renata wants to do those things, but doesn't know how to say it without rage. She's someone that always lives outside the club. I feel such sisterhood with the girls. We deeply love each other. And for Reese and Nicole, and I particularly, all having done this since we were teenagers, and never having acted with so many women, it's amazing. But Renata isn't the easiest. I go to work every day, and I bring to it the idea that I don't fit in. Vallée, who has known Dern since they did Wild, calls her skill magic, and explains just how infectious her mischievous energy can be. She's like a little kid. One of us will suggest something and go, "Let's not tell the others." She loves it so much because we're going to surprise everyone else, including the crew. Remember when Renata's friend comes over to gossip, and Renata turns and screams to scare the shit out of her? We didn't tell anyone. I probably should have told the DP because he almost dropped the camera. Everybody had a heart attack except Laura and myself. I couldn't stop laughing. Next photos, playing her parts. Dern with Jeff Goldblum. Richard Attenborough, and Sam Neill in 1993's Jurassic Park, with Nicolas Cage in 1990's Wild at Heart and 2017's Big Little Lies. Another recent role for which she did a particularly deep dive was HBO's The Tale, the brutal story of a woman forced to reevaluate what her 13-year-old self had deemed a consensual relationship with an older man. The Tale dredged up a lot of Dern's own memories, ones she had long suppressed or put in neat narrative boxes. I started making movies as an 11-year-old, so I was on location at 13, which is a different thing. I remember every compromised situation, she says. I was a child, and adults took advantage of me, or tried, and I justified the behavior as me misunderstanding it. That leads to a discussion of the necessity of Time's Up, hashtag Me Too and beyond. But as important as all this awareness and change is, from personal safety to equal pay, she's also aware that the hashtags can put undue pressure on assault survivors to join the chorus. Those who stay silent can feel self-conscious or cowardly. No one has to speak about their experience, she says. It's also remarkably brave to sit in your own home and look in the mirror and say, "This is the truth of what happened. I will tell you I experienced everything barring assault." I mean, there were a million of these circumstances where what director or casting director needs a 13-year-old to go to the chateau to audition in a room, sitting on a bed beside the director, to read a scene together, alone? You just don't create that scenario. There was behavior that was definitely the worst kind of behavior that somehow I got myself out of, or someone stopped it. Or, I posit, it happened because you were protected, and these men were testing their limits. My dad killed John Wayne, she quips. He might kill you, too. The tragedy of my life is that when things were in the gray, I didn't know they were wrong. I didn't know I was entitled to say something as simple as, "I feel a little uncomfortable. Can someone else be in the room?" Or, "No, I don't want to come with you to get a book you're going to give me as a wrap present in your hotel room." Or, you know, that ultimate grooming line for young girls. "What's that? I see you and I understand you like nobody else does." When she picks me up the next morning, I find it difficult to hide my disappointment. I am set to tag along with her for a tour of the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, opening later this year, the fundraising for which Dern is helping to spearhead. The museum, which shares a campus with LACMA, will house decades worth of screenplays, photographs, and film paraphernalia, from Dorothy's ruby slippers to one of the iPhones Sean Baker used to make Tangerine. But right now, it's still under construction. The site's dress code advises full-length pants, jeans are best, and a sleeved shirt. A t-shirt is fine. Hard hats and vest will be provided. I follow these instructions to the letter, but when I open Dern's car door, I see an alabaster hand resting on the steering wheel, and attached to it the sleeve of an artfully frayed black blazer with silver chains. "Oh, come on," I say. "What is that?" "It's long-sleeved." "No, really, what is it?" "It's McQueen," she gives in, laughing. She looks down at the blazer and silk blouse beneath it. "It's more what Renata would wear to a construction site," she allows. In her defense, our goals for this tour are different. Mine is to learn more about Dern's passion for Hollywood's history and future, and hers is to help entice high-level investors to support this 50,000-square-foot industry tribute. Still, one gets the sense this is a typical Dern outfit. She is a natural power dresser with an actor's love for costume and an artist's love for the sartorial. The night before, she wore custom rodarte to the governor's ball. Dern's son, Ellery, modeled for Rafe Simons. Her white Calvin Klein column gown at last year's Oscars was so classy you could scream. All this has bred an allergy to relegating fashion to what are you wearing? I don't love bougie things, you know. I have pieces that are so Renata, but the difference between us is I dress for how I want to feel, as opposed to how I want people to feel about me. Then her phone rings. Her daughter, Jaya, who is desperate to see the museum, will be joining us on the tour. I ask if her kids have seen her more sexually frank work, particularly Wild at Heart. They have not. David Lynch was at the house recently, and he advised her son not to see Wild at Heart until age 30. And Ellery goes, "Is it because my mom's kind of sassy in the movie?" And David goes, "No, it's not you seeing your mother I'm worried about. It's seeing your grandmother." And suddenly, I'm seeing this image of my mom painting her face red and going up to my boyfriend and saying, "How'd you like to F Lula's mama?" And, oh my God, that's my children's grandmother. F. Jaya skips toward us beneath the LACMA lamppost. She is a 14-year-old incarnation of Dern, funny, sophisticated, and gaining on her mom in height. Throughout the tour, mother and daughter rib and hug each other. Jaya hangs on her neck for dramatic effect when she's bored. Right now, she wants to be either a journalist or an actress when she grows up. We ride up a freight elevator with the rest of the tour group and are released into the sound of drilling and hammering. Dern speaks to the group as the wind whips at our eye gear, and I hang back with Jaya, who's no fan of heights. I hear bits and pieces. Her audience is rapt. She has the most gorgeous voice, Kidman told me. No one really talks about her voice, but I find her voice very soothing. It's like balm. We want to continue. Essential, women and diversity in film. When I was a kid. Jaya nods respectfully. She has heard her mom give this speech before. This really is Dern's self-described passion plea. She's even done some of the oral archiving herself. Next on her docket are interviews with her father and Jack Nicholson. According to her father, this reverence for the past has always been there. "We had a daughter who died," he tells me over the phone one night. "She drowned at 18 months, and Laura was born 5 years later. When Laura was 7 years old, we were driving, and she turned to me, and she said, 'I miss my sister.' And I looked at her and I thought, 'What a thing to hear from a 7-year-old. And that made me know she is just on a different plane. Laura feels. Her sense of history is so strong. Indeed, the fear of losing one's story, of being silenced, comes up repeatedly with Dern in various guises, whether it's the theme of her work, her political views, or her personal history. It's a fear that drives her, that comes out in the wash as contagious fervor. As we walk out, she asks me if I can believe that this place has never existed. I shake my head no. By this point, I too am flabbergasted, as if a crime has been committed. When my father wanted me to learn about film, he used to take me to a wax museum on Hollywood Boulevard. You should have your own wax figurine, Jaya interjects. I have my own Jurassic Park action figure, says Dern. For a late lunch, she suggests we hit up another Hollywood landmark, that storied site of fried chicken and attempted molestation, the Chateau Marmont. As we walk through the boudoir-like lobby, one always feels as if one were stepping into or out of a 50s matinee. I tell her I recently shared the elevator here with her Wild at Heart co-star Willem Dafoe. Oh, she gasps, he's so lovely, and yet every time I see him I feel terrified. Perhaps none of us should see Wild at Heart until we're 30. We sit on a banquette and she surveys the restaurant, bemused, commenting on how funny it is to see all these people starting their lives, starting their careers, being at the chateau in a way she has not been for some time. In addition to Little Women, she has her own production company, Jay Walker Pictures. It's developing a limited series with Issa Rae at HBO, is playing Lara in Jeremiah Terminator Leroy, the J.T. Leroy story, and will star in the next Noah Baumbach movie. Meanwhile, she and Emma Stone have come up with a story together and will be producing it. She's forever on the lookout. As an actor, I'm waiting to be challenged to the depths again, to throw myself into the deep end. It's been a while since I've thought, what am I doing? How am I doing this? And as a person, what is she waiting for? She stares slightly into the middle distance before speaking. I want to share something, but I want to share it in the most respectful way possible because I worship this person. As a child, my biggest influence on a daily basis was Lucille Ball. I had Barbara Stanwyck and Katharine Hepburn on my wall, but Lucy was my everything. She was my daily ritual. And my grandmother didn't understand why I'd get so emotional when I Love Lucy reruns weren't on, and they'd play The Lucy Show instead. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.